GTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and it may be a dreary day here in southeastern Wisconsin, but I'm excited here at WGTD to be able to welcome back into our studios Dr. Thomas Carr, who is Associate Professor of Biology at Carthage and Director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology. And the reason we're having Dr. Carr back on the morning show relatively soon after his most recent visit to the program is because of a presentation of a paper that he's going to be doing very, very shortly for the annual meeting or conference of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. And it is a paper in which he goes into some detail talking about something which is of tremendous concern to him and to other paleontologists and scientists, namely the fact that more and more specimens of T-Rex, Tyrannosaurus rex, are falling into commercial and or private hands versus coming into public trust, as in public museums and so on. And it's something we're seeing more and more of. And the impact on the study of T-Rex and other dinosaurs is very much impacted. And Professor Carr's paper on this, among other things, seeks to really quantify that impact on the study of T-Rex. And so as this annual meeting is just getting underway, we have Dr. Thomas Carr in our studios to talk about this and what he has learned in his study. Dr. Thomas Carr, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me be back on such short notice.
No, I'm really glad that we can have this conversation, and it's a really important topic that I think a lot of people are going to appreciate learning more about. How long has this been a concern of yours? My guess is that it's been maybe a kind of a low-grade concern that's grown over time to the point where you finally felt like, I need to sort of say something about this and do a concerted study of this. But how long has this situation and concern kind of been in the air for you?
Yeah, it's for quite some time. It actually started with the discovery of the T-Rex nicknamed Sue, which fortunately is now on display at the Field Museum. Sue was found back in 1990, and was almost immediately engulfed in controversy just regarding what land it really came from. And Sioux was, you know, seized by the federal government, and ultimately there are several suits for Sioux. And to make a very long story short, Sioux went up for auction, public auction. It could have been purchased by anybody. And fortunately, there was a consortium between the Field Museum, McDonald's, and Disney that were able to scrape together the funds to basically rescue that dinosaur from private hands. There were some other museums competing for Sioux, but the bidding, you know, just soared right past what they were capable of. And so that's one instance where a commercially collected fossil, it was collected by a commercial company that collects and sells fossils. And so Sioux was sort of, you know, rescued by that consortium. If it weren't for that, that fossil might have just disappeared into private ownership. And that did happen. That sad story happened recently with the auction of Stan the T-Rex, which was auctioned, I think, by Christie's and sold for over $30 million into private hands. No one's really sure where it went.
That's right. It was an anonymous bidder, and as far as you know, that successful bidder for this particular specimen has yet to come forward, I mean, to identify themselves.
Right. That bid for Stan, as far as I understand it, came through a London office, which doesn't mean that the bidder is from London. We're not really sure exactly where or who. But the bottom line is that fossil did not go into a museum. It went to a private individual. Just last week, a different species of dinosaur, Triceratops, nicknamed Big John, was auctioned to a private person. In the U.S., the auction was held in Paris. And I think Big John was auctioned off for about $7 million. And so that's a Triceratops that we'll know nothing about, you know, since it's gone to a private individual and not to a museum.
Right. You were saying before we went on the air that the typical museum, particularly a small or kind of medium-sized museum, is very unlikely to have, let's say, $7 million sitting around to spend. I mean, were they to try to engage in a successful attempt to win a specimen like Big John, for instance.
Right. For a museum to do that, it takes a lot of time and effort, a lot of fundraising, and that actually has happened recently. So the North Carolina Museum of Science successfully raised money to get a pair of specimens, a Triceratops and a juvenile T-Rex. And that took a long time to raise those monies, a significant amount. And so here we have a case of a museum successfully, you know, this is sort of similar to Sioux, of sort of rescuing a fossil from private ownership. Mm-hmm. And yeah, museums don't have that type of money lying around. It takes consortia, or it takes tremendous effort and time and energy into fundraising. And so these are not light affairs for museums. You know, like, I guess the range of T-Rexes that have been sold, the amount ranges between $5 million to 31 plus. You know, if you add on the other charges with Stan, the real number's more like $41 million.
Yeah.
But it's an exorbitant amount, and one of my colleagues calls it a ransom amount.
Mm. And it also probably is, we need to say that if a museum finds that kind of money, it's also money that they can't spend in other ways that actually might be even more appropriate for a given museum. I mean, it's taking money away from, for instance, fieldwork and other aspects of studying dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's a good point. Museums have priorities above and beyond acquiring new specimens, and you know, it's a tough world out there, and financially, museums are having a rough time, especially with COVID, the real dip in admissions, that sort of thing. But put this into perspective, for a big museum, let's just say $1 million would be able to fund, say, a decade of fieldwork. And that is, you know, a decade of looking for new fossils. Instead of saying spending all that money on one fossil, you have the opportunity to find many fossils and really build up that scientifically valuable and public education valuable collection of new things. And so spending that sort of money on one specimen does make people balk.
Yeah. With good reason. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, who is Associate Professor of Biology at Carthage and Director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology. And we're talking today about a paper which Dr. Carr is about to present at the annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. It is a study on the effect of the commercial fossil trade on specifically the sample size of T-Rex. I mean, of all of the T-Rex specimens that we have, whether complete or incomplete, how many of those are in commercial or private hands versus public trust, as in public museums? And Dr. Carr has done an extensive study of this after having viewed with mounting alarm the trend that is towards more and more commercial ownership of these kind of specimens. Before we dig into some of these specifics, it might be really good for us to understand kind of this world that we're talking about. In first of all, how you are using the term public trusts versus commercial and private possession of T-Rex specimens. So let's start with the public trust thing.
Sure.
What sort of entities are we talking about that sort of earn that moniker of a public trust?
Right. So this has its roots in the ethics of the science. And so the professional scientific organization of the science is the SVP, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology that you've mentioned, and the annual meeting is sort of has gone live virtually this morning. And any ethics that state that we should be studying fossils that are in public trusts, which are accredited collections, and the accrediting body in the United States is the American Alliance of Museums, so AAM accreditation, and the, for example, the Kenosha Museums Complex are AAM accredited, And what accreditation does is set out a set of standards for museum collections to ensure that the collections are safe from, say, happenstances of climate, weather, natural disasters, that sort of thing, and also responsible stewardship, so infrastructure, staff, that sort of thing, that there are guarantees that the collection will be safe and maintained in perpetuity. Other sorts of designations include federal repositories status, and that's something that the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in downtown Kenosha has, and that's sort of a similar to AAM accreditation in that the institution infrastructure meets some basic requirements, and staffing meets some basic requirements as set out by the Bureau of Land Management, which is under the auspices of the Department of the Interior. So in the U.S., there's a couple types of collections validation or public trust designation. That's obviously, AAM accreditation and federal repository status isn't global, but other countries have their own accreditation and standards. And what that means for me is that I will only include fossils in a federal repository or an AM accredited collection, so that my behavior is in alignment with these expectations and ethics of my science.
And I assume that this kind of accreditation that involves, you know, a public trust also in a sense grants, to some extent, access to scientists.
Yes, that's part of the, I guess, of ensuring that a collection is safe from, commercial exploitation. Somebody prevents people from coming in and say, doing nefarious things. But there is an institutional expectation that the study and research that's done is in alignment with science and academics and that sort of thing, public education as well. Now, in contrast to that, private ownership, if somebody has a T-Rex in their living room, a person's living room does not meet any standard of museum collections, and the most important being that individual ownership of a fossil only lasts as long as that person's alive. There's no guarantee where the fossil will be beyond their lifetime. There's no safeguards that the fossil will be conserved into perpetuity. Often, when a person dies, families don't know what to do with a person's collection that they might view as odd or eccentric. And maybe just throw things out. Like, who knows? There's just no guarantee in place that fossil will be available for science.
Right. In addition to this split between a public trust owning a specimen versus a private collector, you just described someone who has some specimen in their living room or maybe more likely their basement or attic or wherever. But also your study makes reference to commercial ownership and commercial enterprises that are involved in the collection of specimens. Tell us more about that and maybe give us an example or two of the kind of commercial for-profit enterprises that are engaged in the securing of specimens like T-Rexes.
Sure. There's several active such companies in the Northern Rocky Mountain region, in particular South Dakota, Montana. And there's actually been a sort of a recently a TV show, sort of a reality TV show, which follows them around and collecting things. And so these are companies that collect, by and large, on private land with landowners' permission, and they will make some financial deal with the landowners. If something's found, the landowner will get some cut. And so if they find a dinosaur, they'll collect it and will go back to their building, which might have a stockroom space and maybe even a preparation lab and a fabrication lab to mount skeletons, very much sort of like a similar to a museum, but the objective is to sell the fossils, not just to museums, but to anyone. And that's where, part of the problem rears its head. Mm-hmm. And so as long as the fossil's in the stockroom of a commercial company, then that's not in a repository, that's not in a public trust. That's, is equivalent to basically private ownership. It's in the hands of a company that is not charged with the responsibilities of a public trust.
Right. And it sounds like these kind of things are proliferating. So we are seeing more and more of these kind of companies doing more and more out in the field.
Yeah, I haven't actually looked at that side of things. It certainly has that appearance. New companies have popped up in the last, 5 years or so. So I guess we could say that there is a trend. And the upshot is this: for T-Rex, T-Rex is an iconic dinosaur. It has a lot of cultural cachet, and so it is a popular item for people to want to own. And so it's a target of commercial collectors. And if we count up the number of specimens that would be very useful in a scientific study. So last June, June 2020, I published an article, a huge study on growth in T-Rex, which included about 44 T-Rexes, which is almost all of the scientifically informative ones. If we actually count up the number of scientifically valuable T-Rexes in public trusts versus those in stockrooms or those that have been sold to private individuals, it's basically 50-50. Half of the scientifically important T-Rexes are out of the reach of science. Mm-hmm. And that's, in my view, an unacceptable situation. And part of my motivation for drawing this data together was more for my colleagues to alert them to just quite how bad things are on my side of the fence. And so that's the goal of the poster, is to, you know, as you said, to quantify the situation.
Right, raise concern and awareness. Yeah. And I think one thing you were just starting to touch on this, I think, is one area of acute concern for you specifically involves specimens of juvenile T-Rex.
Yeah.
Because those are much less plentiful than specimens of fully grown adult T-Rex. And it sounds like, this is also a very serious situation in terms of how many of those specimens, which right from the start are less plentiful, how many of those are in commercial or private hands.
Right. So most of the specimens of T-Rex that are in museums or have been found are adults. Adults are big. T-Rex grew up to 40 feet long. The bones are not small. And so there's a bias, a preservational bias, it's called, that will tend to find adult skeletons just by dint of size. They're massive. They're easily preserved in the rock record. But the young animals are small and delicate. They're basically giant flightless birds. You know, they have hollow bones, and in the Hell Creek Formation, which is the unit of rock where T-Rex comes from, it's a river deposit environment. The rocks are deposited by rivers, and those are pretty rough on small animals, young T-Rexes included. We don't find many small meat eaters or small dinosaurs at all because of that. It's a high energy environment, it's called. And so for juveniles, there's a handful. And among the privately held, commercially held T-Rexes, there's about 10 of those. And if those were suddenly made their way into museums, we'd double our sample size of juveniles. And also we'd learn much more about the earliest stages of growth in this dinosaur, which currently is based on, you know, a handful of specimens, and not all of them are that complete. The ones that are in commercial hands sort of run the spectrum of incomplete to fairly good, so it would complement what we have quite nicely and really flesh out our knowledge of the biology of this iconic dinosaur. But without them, we're stuck with a very incomplete picture.
Right. As you were talking about that, you said something about, you know, all of these specimens that are, I don't remember how you said it, like beyond our reach or unavailable to us.
Right.
Is it at least theoretically possible that a specimen that is in commercial hands or private hands could conceivably be made available to scientists? Is that just so unlikely that it doesn't even sort of figure into these equations? I mean, is it possible for a commercial company or even a private individual to hold a specimen and have enough interest in the advancement of science that they might make their specimen available? Does that ever happen? Is it likely to happen?
Well, the bottom line is it doesn't matter. If the fossil isn't in a public trust, then it's not going to be studied. I mean, that is the scientific ethical position, is that if we're going to study a fossil, it has to be in a public trust, you know, period. And that's why this issue is so serious.
I guess what I'm imagining, and maybe you can correct me, but I'm imagining a scenario where individual X, who paid $10 million for such a specimen and houses it in his basement, what if he called up Dr. Thomas Carr and had you come over and welcomed you to study that specimen? In what way is that, in a sense, an impossibility or kind of a contradiction to the way it's supposed to be?
It's an impossibility because the person's private residence is not a public trust. And that is the that's the standard, is that the original fossil, if it's going to be studied, should be in a public trust, because a public trust has all those guarantees of the fossil being stewarded in perpetuity. And there's this another scientific consideration at play here, and that's reproducibility of observations. So let's say I go to, you know, our imaginary privately owned T-Rex, and I do a complete study of it, and then say it winds up on auction block and disappears, or let's say the person's place burns down, the fossil along with it, then no
or
one
if
can
the
spe- go.
Or if the specimen degrades because it's not being properly preserved.
Right. And so no one can go back to the original fossil and test my original measurements or observations.
Right.
So the notion of a public trust is to preserve the collection of fossils or objects. You know, this includes all museum objects, is that the fossils are there in one place that can be studied time and time again by qualified researchers to test the original observations. You know, that's the cornerstone of science. And without that guarantee of the fossils being stewarded responsibly for all time, then it's just a risk that's too high to take. It's not worth it.
So in other words, in order to really properly understand this concern, it's really important to understand the scientific process of what scientific study and research really is and what is required in order to do that study to the highest level.
Yes.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, Associate Professor of Biology at Carthage and Director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology. Professor Carr is about to present a paper to the annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, in which he underscores and tries to quantify the impact of commercial fossil trade on the sample size of T-Rex and thus the impact on scientific study of T-Rex. One name that we've bandied about, a couple of names, I think a lot of our listeners are well acquainted with, Sue, who is held in is that at the Field Museum in Chicago? Yes. And that was kind of an instance that sort of touched all of this off. Another name that you mentioned that might not be quite as well known, although in some respects it's an even more significant story, is that of Stan the T-Rex, a very impressive specimen that was found in South Dakota, I think back in the late 80s, and excavated shortly thereafter, and ultimately in a recent auction went to the highest bidder for $31.8 million. Explain to whatever you happen to know about this particular specimen, how it is that it didn't find its way into a museum the way so many other specimens do. What was it about how it was found, by whom, and who held it for a while that it ultimately ended up on the auction block in this way?
Right. So it was discovered by an amateur collector and who has a close relationship with the Black Hills Institute of Geological Research Incorporated, which is based or was based in Hill City, South Dakota. And so the BHI collected Stan, prepared it, and it was sort of a showpiece in their showroom. They mounted the skeleton. It was fairly complete. And they did open their doors to scientists to study Stan, which they did, despite the fact that it wasn't a public trust. In my earlier student days, I did the same. I didn't have a clear idea of where the ethical lines were, and I basically followed bad examples by senior colleagues. I probably should have known better. So,
are you saying you went and studied Stan?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
And part of and that was, yeah, not the right decision to make. But it was early days for me, and these things weren't all that clear at that time.
And we should just clarify, because the name you cited in terms of the organization or corporation that owned, yeah. I guess when we hear incorporated in the title, that should tell us something. So this, at a glance, it seems like a valid scientific enterprise, but in fact it is a commercial venture that owned Stan essentially right from the start.
Right, that's correct. And for whatever reason, Stan was studied. It's actually in the scientific literature. In terms of the poster, I don't go into that side of things, but in the article that the poster is drawn from, I do actually go into this side of things, is how privately owned T-Rexes have made it into the scientific literature, and that's another story unto itself. But to return to Stan, my understanding is that the BHI fell on some financial hardship, interpersonal conflict, and a court ordered the parties to, settle their differences in part by selling Stan off to raise monies. I don't know all the details of this, but sort of Stan was a casualty of issues within the BHI, and so ultimately it wound up on the auction block, and went for an extraordinarily high amount of money. I think it's worth pointing out that the BHI, in a similar fashion, was at the center of the first major auction of a dinosaur, namely Sue, which went for, at the time, a little over $7 million, and that was a record-breaking price, and really alerted, I think, people out west to the commercial value of fossils. And so here again, a few decades later, the BHI is at the center of another high-ticket item.
Wow. Yes, namely $31.18 million was the final price tag for this specimen known as Stan, and that makes it the most expensive fossil ever sold. Or that's my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns about this is what can be done about this when we are kind of talking about commercial exploits that are sort of feel like a runaway train of sorts. If I recall correctly, your paper touches on some of the places where in certain countries, maybe even certain states or provinces where certain protections or restrictions help at least curb this activity and maybe in some places outlaw it altogether. What can you tell us about how the response that there has been to this in certain places that might kind of serve it for how this might be handled here in the United States?
Yeah, it's so bottom line is that the situation in the U.S. where fossils can be sold from private land isn't universal. So let's just start with the U.S. In the American West, land is sort of a patchwork of private land, state land, and federal land, public land. And that's a vestige of the early days of the railroad. So these patches of federal land were actually set aside for the railways should they see fit to extend. That's a whole history unto itself. But what we're left with is this patchwork. And so on federal and state land, let's say in Montana, the fossils are under the protection of the Paleontological Resources Protection Act, PRRPA. And so the rules there are that, you know, qualified researchers from institutions can collect fossils following scientific protocols, and those fossils would go back to a federal repository, a public trust. And there's similar protections for fossils found on state land as well. Private land, they can do whatever they want with it, including the fossils, and so that's where we see the commercial exploitation happening. Just interesting side note, before Sioux happened, museums out in Montana, they would collect 90% of their fossils from private land. So they'd spend 90% of their time on private land and maybe 10% of the time on public land and state land. After Sioux, it was completely reversed because the commercial folks had basically come in, cut deals with landowners, shoving the academic paleontologist off of private land.
Wow.
And that trend continues to this day. And in the auctions of Big John and Stan certainly would reinforce that. So we have this mix of land in the United States, but we have other countries like Canada, France, Italy, Mongolia, where the fossils are protected by law. If you say, for example, in the state of Alberta, you may own land, but the land underneath the ground is called crown land. And if there's a dinosaur in the ground on your property, it actually belongs to the province, and you are to, if you find such a fossil, you say alert a local museum to the fact that there's a, and take a look and assess it and maybe even collect it. And so there is no trade, commercial fossil trade in dinosaur fossils in the province of Alberta. You know, it's just legally, it's a non-starter. And that has to do, I guess, a bit with sort of the history of Canada. So there's a deeper historical axis here in terms of how land is and ownership is conceived, which is historically. So I don't think that can be exactly mapped onto the situation here. But the idea that a fossil belongs to everybody, I think, is an idea that can spread and is worth considering. So I've no illusions that that such a change would happen here overnight. I think that part of this issue of the commercial trade of dinosaur fossils, there's going to be any movement to protect dinosaur fossils on private land, that's an incremental cultural change. Maybe the value of dinosaurs is the information they contain, and that information outweighs, say, some monetary gain. I think I think that's the concept that has to gain traction. And I'm sure that that's a process that would take a century or two. It's obviously not going to happen in my lifetime, realistically. You know, the American West is economically depressed. There's no one would blame a landowner for wanting, you know, a shot in the arm from a nice dinosaur skeleton. But there is, I think it's important to point out that there is a scientific cost at the same time that might be worth considering.
You mentioned these restrictions, for instance, in the province of Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like in Canada, it's kind of province by province by province. Whether there are restrictions at all, or if there are, how severe those restrictions are.
Yes.
Could you imagine a scenario in the United States, for instance, in which a given state could enact laws and restrictions that would apply in a similar sort of way?
That's an interesting question. I'm certainly no legal scholar. I'm sure that something like that were to happen, it would be on a state-by-state basis. A referendum on the topic, might lead to laws that would apply to private land. That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
And then what about other countries? I think you mentioned Italy and Mongolia and so on. Are we talking about situations there that are roughly akin to what you were describing in, for instance, Alberta, Canada? In terms of what they have, what kind of laws and restrictions they have in place?
Yeah. So my understanding is that in France, there are laws in place that protect all fossils, just period. Actually, we had a documentary film crew from France with us this summer, interviewing me about the impending auction of Big John and sort of the academic view of that, which I'm sure you can gather what that would be, but we had an interesting conversation about how in France such a thing would not be possible, that fossils there are protected by law, and in fact there are dinosaur localities in France. There's some quite well known egg localities and skeletons, and there's also fossil mammals, more recent things there, but they're all protected. Mongolia also has legal protection of dinosaur fossils, but they're really hard hit by basically the black market. So they have people coming up from China that will basically remove the heads and feet of dinosaur fossils from the famous Nemegt dinosaur fossil beds. The vandalism is jaw-dropping and dispiriting.
Wow.
They're going after claws and teeth for TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. And so there's that. And also there's the black market in dinosaur fossils themselves. So, skulls and such will find their way or have found their way to auction houses, say, in Europe, United States. Mongolia has really made real efforts to clamp down on that. And they've worked with many countries to actually repatriate dinosaur fossils back to Mongolia. So Mongolia is quite active in this. They're being really hard hit. And that's certainly an angle of this story that, that my poster doesn't cover. I'm very focused on T-Rex, since that's the animal I study. But Mongolia is just a whole other game of cards. It's literally the Wild West out there. But there's a very good book published recently on that whole issue called The Dinosaur Artist, and it follows the story of a particular dinosaur skeleton that was collected illegally from Mongolia, spirited off to the UK, and then a commercial person in Florida tried to get it in to the US. It was seized, and there was a court case and all the rest of it. But that's an example of the situation in Mongolia and how international that picture is. And actually, in a similar way, the issue with T-Rex is international. Since the fossils are actually leaving the U.S., there's several privately owned T-Rexes that are now overseas and that the people of the U.S. will almost certainly never see.
Right. And yeah, it makes them even less likely to be accessed by the scientific community. We should probably underscore the fact that the expeditions that you go on quite often in the summertime involve public lands.
Right.
And when you find things there, those are almost certainly destined, their ultimate destiny will be a public trust of one kind or another.
Right. So to avoid any, you know, unfortunate entanglements, we collect strictly on public lands. And what I like about that is there's a layer of transparency there that we're actually accountable to the BLM. We actually submit an annual report of what we've found. And right now, my preparator, Dr. Megan Seitz, and I are cataloging every fossil that was collected this summer. So we submit that report at the end of the year. And it gets us moving on cataloging everything so we know what we have and we can alert colleagues to interesting things. But to your point, yes, the Dinosaur Discovery Museum is a federal repository and is AM accredited. And so it is a, you know, it's a public trust. It's where these fossils should go for the enjoyment of everybody.
And in particular for scientists like yourself to be able to properly study them over time.
Yes.
Well, you've raised some really important and intriguing issues in this conversation and, of course, in this paper. We just have a minute or so, but sure. Can you describe ultimately in what sort of format you're going to be presenting this study and what you will be presenting even beyond the what we've discussed today?
Sure. So I'm presenting in the poster, which will be online for people registered to the meeting to see. It summarizes the impact of commercial collection on the sample size of T-Rex, and the take-home message is basically half the fossils are in commercial hands and therefore unavailable to study. So there's about 50 fossils in museums that I would include in a study like the one I did, and I would be bumped up to over 100 if only these really nice fossils were suddenly whisked into public trust. You know, we'd learn so much more about T-Rex. This will ultimately be submitted as an article that includes all of that information, but also, as I mentioned earlier, the issue of scientists actually publishing on commercially or privately owned fossils. And that's another angle of things that that is of concern and is worth alerting people to. And that we really need to be aware of what the ethics guidelines are, and maybe we should do our best to align our behavior for the integrity of our science.
Very well put. Dr. Thomas Carr is Associate Professor of Biology at Carthage College and Director of Carthage's Institute of Paleontology. Dr. Carr, this has been a really interesting conversation. I learned a whole lot, and I suspect our listeners have as well. And I appreciate you joining us today on the morning show. Very best wishes to you, and thank you for alerting all of us to this really important concern.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's 8:59 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, Paul Shields, the author of a very intriguing book called Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee from Scout to Go Set a Watchman. On Wednesday, Dr. Rick Biella, who is the conductor in residence of the Carthage Choir this semester. Professor Biella is one of the country's most renowned choral conductors, and we will be having a conversation with him just ahead of the college's fall choral concert, which is coming up this Sunday. On Thursday, Claude Clegg, the author of a book called The Black President, Hope and Fury in the Age of Obama. And on Friday, Paul Sexton, best-selling author, whose most recent book is called Prince, Portrait of an Artist. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and it's also available as a podcast 7 days a week. Be sure to subscribe to The Morning Show with Greg Berg to